times in college, and I'm standing in the most hallowed ground of baseball immortality, trying to get ready for a game that I'm pitching against the best prospects in all of baseball, and like 95% of these guys are big leaguers, you know, at some point, and I'm just like, came to that realization, like, man, this is, I'm close.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball Americas from Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, we're talking to former minor league right-hander Kevin Posadas. Kevin was a 17th round pick out of Division II Limestone College in 2006. While most organizations don't have the highest of hopes for their 17th round picks out of small schools, 2 years after being drafted, Kevin was pitching in Yankee Stadium in the Futures game. We talk about that journey, the incredible early minor league success he had, sharing clubhouses with future World Series champions like Pablo Sandoval and Tim Lincecum, and the art of the knuckleball, something that he tried to master towards the end of his career. This is the first episode of From Phenom to the Farm that has ever been recorded in person. I want to thank Free Roam Brewing and former Giants left-hander Jeremy Affeld for letting us use their recording studio. Now, they have some fancy equipment. It is a professional setup over at Free Roam, and I will say, I was unfamiliar with the equipment, so we have some audio disparity between Kevin and I. I got it cleaned up a little bit, so it's okay. Just going to be a little bit different than the normal audio quality of the show, but again, that is all user error, and I do think the benefit of being in person led to an awesome conversation between Kevin and I. So I want to thank him for the time. I want to thank Free Roam and Jeremy again for letting us use their studio. If you are ever in Bernie, Texas, which is about like 15 to 20 minutes north of San Antonio, by all means, go into Free Roam. It's a great spot. Good beer, good food trucks. You know, there's such thing as no free ads in podcasting, but they let us use their studio. So shout out to Free Roam. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to baseballamerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. The top 100 prospects are here. Top 200 draft prospects are here. College baseball going strong. The World Baseball Classic is going strong. Coverage for all of that is over on BA. It is always a good time to be a subscriber. Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Kevin Posadas live from Free Roam Brewing in Bernie, Texas.
All right, joining in for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm, the first episode of From Phenom to the Farm actually recorded in person. He was a 17th round pick of the Giants in 06 out of Limestone College, former Futures game participant and member of the storied fraternity of knuckleballers, Kevin Posadas. Kevin, thanks so much for joining me here on From Phenom to the Farm.
Absolutely. Welcome to Bernie, man. This is a great thing here, being able to do the first live recording. This is pretty unbelievable.
I know. I want to shout out Free Roam Brewery in Bernie, Texas. No, you know, there's the saying in podcasting, no free ads, but they're letting us record here, so free ad.
Absolutely. We got a free ad and free beer here. Compliments to Jeremy Affeld, a former teammate of mine with the Giants. Pretty crazy that, you know, all these ball players end up finding their way back to Bernie. I mean, I was just taking my son to school yesterday morning and ran into Josh Beckett here in Bernie, you know, who has a ranch down Sisterdale Road. And right across the street here is 38 and Vine, and that the owner of that is Sam Demmel.
A former guest of this podcast, Sam Demmel.
I know. I did my research. I saw that.
Yeah, cool to be doing this in person. You and I have circled the wagons on this for 2 years, maybe?
Something like that. It's been a process.
Connected via work thing, but let's jump right into it. When did you realize you had a future at the next level of baseball? For you, that being college baseball.
Well, honestly, I feel like I really never did because I was cut twice from a high school team, believe it or not. I was 5'10" when I graduated from high school, you know, so, and I threw about 82 miles an hour, but I was always a super command control style pitcher. But I had a little bit of tenacity about me. I always thought I threw harder than that, and I don't know, you call it denial or whatever else. I thought I was an upper 80s guy, and it turned out I was really only throwing about 81, 82, 83, somewhere around in there. And I had one scholarship offer from Limestone College, a small Division II school in South Carolina, and I took it in order to get an education, and pro baseball was never really a thought. It was just, hey, let's use this as fuel for the destination of getting my college degree. And next thing you know, I caught a late growth spurt and then, you know, started throwing 93, 94 miles an hour. And then pro team started knocking down my door. And I thought, man, you know, this might actually happen.
We talked about this off mic, but when we first connected, but Division II baseball is a different kind of grind than high level Division I baseball. It's something we've had a theme on the show and we've had smaller school guys, but it especially depends on how the program's funded, how, you know, spending is handled. There's a lot of variety at Division II programs. You're doing lots of field work. There's long cramped bus rides. You're not staying at the Marriott's. Is there ever a point where you thought, like during those years at Limestone College, where you're like, Division II baseball isn't for me?
You know what? I thought Division II was great in the moment. I look back on it now. You know, obviously, I saw a lot of more green pastures. I guess so the longer I got around and the more I played. But Division II, I mean, I truly believe it helped prep me for the everyday grind of the minor leagues. I mean, eating peanut butter and jellies out of coolers and, you know, just getting whatever you could. I mean, obviously the parents and, you know, the boosters and things like that were heavily involved with the program. But funny thing about Limestone is Hall of Famer Gaylord Perry, who recently passed away, was the original founder of Limestone. So naturally when I got drafted by the Giants, I was able to meet him and hang out with him. I'd met him before, but, you know, he didn't really remember me and I wouldn't remember me either at the time. But it was cool to see him in the Giants clubhouse. He would always come around with Willie Mays and Willie McCovey and those guys, you know, during spring training, to do their talks and things like that. So it was always fun to, make that introduction and make that connection again. And then, you know, after I was around for a couple of years in Major League camp, he'd always be like, "Where's my Limestone guy at?" So that was always pretty cool.
So with a Gaylord Perry connection at Limestone, when you got to college, was there like an introduction to loading up the ball? Like, did they lay out a bunch of substances and it's like, okay, pick your favorite and let's figure out how you're going to make the ball spin with this?
You know what's crazy? And I've told some of the players that, you know, I'm still connected to this day that are making their journey, you know, up through the minor leagues and everything, that I really wasn't a fan, you know? Like, I tried messing around with it a little bit early on, but it always seemed like for whatever reason, I don't know if because I relied so much on, like, control and command. For me, like, I kind of wish I probably would have spent more time, you know, messing with it when it was completely, you know, legal, not scrutinized, not controversial, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, it always caused me to spike the ball, and I always would spike breaking balls with it and stuff like that. So I kind of wish now, looking back, that I would have tinkered with it a little bit more. But at the time, I really didn't like it. It was out of my comfort zone. And, you know, I felt like I was getting wins and getting outs and doing my thing just fine without it. But obviously hindsight's 20/20.
You mentioned you eventually saw greener pastures in baseball, and a lot of that comes probably AAA playing in Latin America. Those are the greener pastures. When you get to the minor leagues, it's a lot like the lower levels of the minor leagues, especially when you came up in the late 2000s, really similar, and it's something we talked about in the show before, to Division II baseball. Not the nicest buses in the world, not the nicest hotels in the world. When you're on teams, you're sharing clubhouses with guys who were, you know, played at big Division I schools who, you know, there's a lot of comfort there, or, high school guys who just were living with mom and dad. There's a lot of comfort there. Does Division II baseball, in a way, or just small school baseball, because you coach at junior college as well, does it maybe prep you for life in the low minors, maybe a little bit better in some aspects than a top-tier Division I school or high school?
So for me, in Division II, and probably the most experience I had was playing in front of crowds. I mean, was a big adjustment for me, because, I mean, usually, you know, you got 100 people there at your home games, you know, at a D2 school, and
oh, that's a sellout right there at D2.
Yeah, for sure. In our conference tournament, you know, we had about 1,500, but it was mostly like players, families waiting for their team to come. It wasn't like people that were deeply rooted or deeply connected to Limestone for the most part. You know, we still had our 50 blue bloods kind of thing, but I'll never forget it. I mean, I was thrown into my first professional, outing. It was in Spokane, Washington, and there were 8,000 people in the stands, and the most I'd ever thrown it, you know, against was in the Coastal Plain League, you know, 1,500, 2,000, and you get thrown in front of that, your professional debut, and you're just like, man, I'm not in Kansas anymore type thing, you know, but for me, going from D2 specifically, like where I came from, I mean, we had a chain link fence in my Division II program. when I first got in and was recruited. I mean, it literally felt like a cow pasture. And then they put some money into it as we got better and things like that as I kind of progressed along in my junior and senior year. But getting into minor leagues, like, the minor leagues felt like the big leagues to me, if we're just being completely honest. Like, it was so grand compared to where I came from that every outing felt like literally I had come so far.
And is there a benefit to that? It feeling that big?
For me, there was, because it kept me really sharp and really focused, at least early on. You know, my first several, I'd say 2 or 3 years in the minor leagues, I don't think there was anybody that had a better record than me. I mean, I think my first full season, I had the lowest earned run average in all of professional baseball. I mean, essentially, they called it a minor league Cy Young Award, you know, and it really helped me make sure that I was pitching for the right reasons, because, like I said, every day felt like the big leagues to me. I mean, it really did. I just didn't know any other way to approach it, and that's just genuinely how it felt every time.
When you got drafted in the 17th round, and with that, you mentioned you played in the Coastal Plains League, which, you know, typically has some higher level players, some Division I guys, but in college, you know, your weekend series, you're not facing UNC, you're not facing NC State. How, when you go into that professional environment, do you, you know, did you have a lot of confidence in yourself of, oh, I can make this, I can succeed here, when you don't really have as much of the track record or the prestige of a prospect? Because, you know, high schoolers all play against high schoolers, but if you're drafted out of high school, they say, hey, you're this prospect. You're a 17th round pick. You went to Division II school. How do you find confidence in that moment to go out and succeed?
Well, for me, I mean, my first 2 years of college, I mean, I started getting some starts, you know, going into my second year. I actually, like, was on a JV team in college, which was not expected, but it was good for my growth and development, at least initially. And then second year, I started getting some looks in the weekend rotation and stuff. And then, you know, I kind of stuck after that. But when it really kind of came to a head that I could potentially do this was when I played in that Coastal Plain League. I'm playing against some D1 guys. I started getting some recognition for being able to go against these D1 guys and be successful. And as soon as I did that, in that summer league, it felt more like professional baseball. You're taking day trips, occasional overnighter, you know, like you're playing every single day. It's not a college typical schedule. I mean, you're somewhere every day. And I really felt like that experience was invaluable for me as far as my development, because then I looked at it like, okay, I'm pitching against D1 guys every fifth day in summer ball, and they all have, you know, really notable programs, you know, Big 12, SEC, whatever it may be. And then I'm like, man, when I get back to Limestone, I'm going to be unstoppable going back against D2 level competition. And that's when I started really getting a lot of my confidence, and it borderline like cockiness, you know, a little bit of arrogance started coming in there, because I had that success. I took it back, and then I started knowing that I was one of the best arms in Division II that year.
Before we get into the minors, I actually want to touch on something you just said about you're on a JV team earlier in college. I would imagine with that came actually getting some innings and stuff that if you had been with the actual college team or whatever, you might not have gotten. And I think in today's, you know, especially with kids leaving high school, whatever, there are a lot of kids who will say, I want to go, you know, I want to go play for this program, or I want to go to a 4-year school, or I don't want to go to junior college, I don't want to go to a small school. How valuable is just playing, even if those are JV innings, they don't even count in NCAA, whatever. How much value and how much of your development do you credit to just playing as a freshman or a sophomore, as opposed to, you know, sitting the bench and watching other guys pitch?
I think repetition, I mean, if for any baseball guy at any level, repetition is key. I mean, you have to hate to get bored, you know, and I can always tell when, you know, I was recruiting guys as a junior college coach, or now, you know, as an advisor with, you know, some arms that are in the minor leagues. It's, I mean, I've got a couple guys right now that, you know, like the Texas guy I was talking to you about earlier, you know, just signed his contract today. He's in with San Fran, and which was awesome. That, you know, because I deeply care for that kid and his family. Awesome situation. And I just told him, like, you are about to get literally a PhD in baseball at the minor leagues. Like, because people think, oh, University of Texas, they're a college blue blood. They are, but he didn't get near the repetition that he's going to see at least initially in these first 3 or 4 months of the minor leagues, his first time going at it, like, it's a completely different level of reps. And I honestly, like, kind of took that approach early because I had a few guys that were from my hometown that kind of were steering me and advising me that way, that got into the minor leagues pretty early and were like, listen, you have to get the reps. You have to pitch whenever you can. Every time you get on a mound, it's super vital and super important. It's better to be playing at a lower level, you know, every day, like on a JV team, than literally just waiting around for your chance. So go out there and be proactive and do something about it.
You get into the minor leagues and you get, you know, back when they had short season, you get 70 short season innings in right after you sign. But you head out to full season ball. And like you mentioned, essentially like a minor league Cy Young year. You lead the minor leagues in ERA. You go from 17th round D2 guy to a guy who's on the map. You and just like looking at scouting reports on Baseball America, you know, just reading about you, didn't have anything overwhelming that stood out about you on the mound. You were 88 to 90, which even back then was not like, you're not blowing it past guys. You had quality breaking stuff, quality control. When you get into the minor leagues with that and you put up better numbers than your college numbers, where do you associate that success with if you're a guy with average stuff? Because now we look at, you know, it's all about what it looks like on the TrackMan or on the, you know, the Rapsodo or whatever. And you've got to have these incredible spin rates, incredible velocity. How did you make those numbers happen, really?
Well, for me, I think it really boiled down to, I can remember this moment very vividly, you know, my first time ever on a six pack in spring training, you know, throwing, and, you know, I've got meeting Dominican players for the first time, you know, seeing guys with stuff I had never seen before at the Division II level in summer ball, anything like that, like ungodly stuff. And, you know, I'm looking over at them and I'm trying to be the best self-evaluator I can, because your most successful baseball players are incredible self-evaluators. And I looked at it like, okay, if I try and be these guys right here, you know, like, there is no way that I'm going to be able to carve out any niche for myself anywhere. And I took a lot of pride on being a workhorse type guy. I mean, dude, in D2, I was throwing 157 pitches, like, a game. My last college outing, in front of like 30 scouts, 158 pitches, you know, like, I was throwing complete games. Like, I understood that was my role.
Times were different as well.
Times were completely different, but like, I was a guy that, I was not a soft tissue guy. I would always take the ball every fifth day, you know, or seventh day, whatever it was in college. Like, I was a guy that you're going to have to rip the ball out of my hand type. I'm going to go seven no matter what, you know, like, my complete game numbers were crazy. I mean, I threw complete games in that year in low A. I mean, like, that was my mentality. I knew that if I was ever going to have a shot at cracking on a roster, I was going to have to be like a fifth starter or long relief guy. I just kind of knew that. I wasn't really aspiring to be much more. And now I look back at it and I'm like, oh, maybe I should have, like, you know, done more to try and add some more velocity. But, I mean, I had times occasionally where I could get 92, 93, and I had 94 a couple times in special situations. But, like, I worked the ball at 88 to 91 with sink and with a above-average changeup and a good breaking ball, and that was just, like, my thing. And I knew how to pitch. And that all started from the D2 level and having to do it at 80. That way, when I got the equipment, I already had that skill set, so now it's just, it came easy. It felt like, now I've got a little bit better equipment, and it's just easier. It's more like, kind of like a video game. It's just like, execute, and nobody's going to touch me kind of thing. But what really made the difference for me in that first low A year was, I was in the South Atlantic League. I grew up in the South. So everywhere, every town that we played in, I had friends, family, people that I knew that were coming to watch, and it helped me stay focused, because I didn't want to let anybody down. I didn't want to be an embarrassment to my friends, my family, whatever. So, like, I knew somebody was up there that literally I had a long track record with. So I was like, you know what? I've got to go out and impress them tonight. And, like, literally that helped, because every ballpark I pitched in, I knew somebody, a group of people, whatever. Like, and it really helped me focus for whatever reason, because that was my biggest fear coming out was, well, now they spent a pick on me. You know, let's not disappoint the hometown faithful kind of thing.
I like what you said about self-evaluation, having to be good at that. I think that's just in life in general. Like if you're working in a job that's not baseball, that's important. You also have to have an idea of how your employer values you. In baseball, that's especially important because they control where you're going. They control your career. And I would say in real life, that matters as well. With that, after you turn in that good year, you were a year prior a 17th round Division II guy, essentially kind of a lottery ticket. If you hit, you hit. How did you evaluate yourself in terms of the Giants' plans for you after turning in that big year? Do you feel like, hey, I'm a guy now, I'm not just 17th rounder, or is there still that stigma tied to you? Is that something internal? How do you suddenly try to get a grasp on where you are in this organization?
So for me, after that first year, there was still that stigma of I'm just a D2 kid, you know, like, and I heard the rumblings around spring training because everyone was like, and you hear it from players, you know, like, especially too, you hear it from coaches and you're like, well, I want to see this Posadas kid, you know, that turned in this great year. And then they see me and they're like, really? Like, this guy did that? Like, what are we missing? You know, like, he's an unheralded guy out of a D2, and he's 88 to 92 on a good day, you know, but, like, he didn't walk people, didn't beat himself, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, and you just hear the guys, and they're talking smack, essentially, and they're like, how in the heck did this guy just turn in that year, you know, 15-4 with a 186 or whatever the heck it was? I mean, the guy that ended up beating was Kevin Slowey, who pitched in the big leagues for a long freaking time.
Twins legend.
Yeah, but similar. Yeah, you're a Twins fan. But anyways, like, it just, you know, like, after that first year, I just heard all that, and all the smack talk is what really fueled me. It wasn't, like, inside me being like, well, that was a fluke or whatever. It's just, like, you hear guys talking, you're like, they thought that there's no way in hell I should have been able to do that. So then I carried that into San Jose the next year in a very, very hitter-friendly ballpark and league.
The Cal League is the hitter's league. Now that's low A, but I went and looked. In 2008, the runs per game in the Cal League were half a run higher than the Carolina League, nearly a full run higher than the FSL. And when you're a guy who doesn't, you know, you didn't share a division with High Desert or Lancaster, but, like, when you... You know, when you report again after this, you know, after this great year, but again, without this overwhelming stuff that's wowing people, do you have to change how you go about things when operating in a hitter's environment like that or a hitter's league like that? Because again, when you get to AAA, it's the PCL, which is similarly, you know, a higher offensive league.
For me, the big key was, you know, in those leagues, the home run's always going to be a factor. And I gave up plenty that year. You know, I did, but I think I went back and looked at it later. I think 85%, I think, of my home runs were solo shots. And for me, that's a testament of just not putting extra guys on base, you know, via hit, via walk, you know, whatever. Like, just limiting the damage. And that was something I was always really good at. And I think, too, like, my off-season training after that first year really changed. Because I knew that I was going to be in California. I knew I was going to be in a hitter's league. I knew that I was going to be pitching at some elevation. You know, I knew I was going to be pitching in windy condition. Like, I really took a step that winter off season because I put myself on the map, and then I was able to kind of link up with a facility with ex-major leaguers, Darren Holmes. He owned it. Agent at the time, you know, had funded that for me. And, you know, after I got put on the map, so to speak, and then John Smoltz was a partner in that too. So I started getting around these guys and figuring out what I could do. And that's why I started sinking the ball a lot more. You know, still working in that same, my velocity held. I started sinking the ball a lot more. And that really helped keeping the ball on the ground in those freaking hitter-friendly environments and those hitter-friendly confines out there. I mean, it helped a ton. So that's really the biggest thing that I changed. I worked out and trained for the first time. I was like, this is my job. You know, like, they made it happen for me and they invested in me, and it really made a huge difference into that second year because I had to change a few things, just small adjustments to be able to handle that league because I knew that's kind of where I was going.
And with that off-season workout and training, that's one of the big things that especially guys who without a lot of draft status struggle to figure out how they're going to do that in the off-season because they a lot of times don't have the money for it. Mm-hmm. It's fortunate that you were able to find something, but when you get into, you know, and when you're low A, when you're in high A, and, you know, again, you're a later round guy, probably not a lot to your name. How did you make things work as far as getting yourself proper nutrition, making sure that off season work stayed on your body throughout, you know, throughout the minor league season.
So like I said, I was really fortunate that, you know, I had an agent that was an up and coming agent at the time that represented me, and I felt really comfortable with him, and he kind of had this, you know, connection with Darren, you know, represented Darren for a lot of his playing career. And then my trainer at the time was Matthew Rollins, who now is the owner of Anchor Bats, which is an interesting connection because then he was a trainer, and the name of the place was Acceleration Sports Institute, and it was Darren and John Smoltz's. And like I said, that was really the first time where I was like, you know what, I can't make it eating fast food and peanut butter and jelly. So like, I'll never forget it because I was training at 4:30 to like 6:30 in the morning. And then after I did that, I would work and I was tarring the inside of manholes at my dad's concrete foundry to work for there in Spartanburg and wearing a full respirator, paint suit, the whole bit. And then I would go back in the afternoon for my pen sessions and everything like that as soon as I put in some work time to be able to make some extra money and be able to get me this good nutrition and everything that I needed. And so I would do all of my baseball-specific stuff in the afternoon, early evening, and then all of my rest and recuperation stuff. And really, that was a huge education for me because I was regularly getting cold tubs and, like, really didn't do that. You know, I was regularly getting massages, you know, soft tissue, deep tissue work, stretching, like never had access to any of that stuff at the Division II level. It literally was show and go. Here you go. Here's some Cheetos and a freaking PB&J and like go out there and throw 158 pitches. You know, that was always the way it was. And we'll see you on the other side. So like it really was an education. And I think at that point, it started becoming real that I had a shot. I was starting to become a factor at that point. And then I turned in another great year in high A. I mean, and that kind of springboarded me into not only the Futures game later that summer, but...
You're doing my job for me. I need you to walk me through the Futures game, because you are the Futures game is for the first-round draft picks. It's for the top prospects, typically. Walk me through finding out that you, 17th round, Division II guy, is going to be pitching in the Futures game.
Still to this day, I don't know how. You know, I really don't.
I mean, every team has to have somebody.
Oh, yeah, they do. Well, we had two. Well, actually, we had three that year. It was Nate Sheerholtz was with me on Team USA, and then we had Angel Villalona that was on the world team. Oh, actually, we had four, and then Pablo Sandoval.
Oh, he turned out pretty good.
Yeah, he turned out pretty good. And Nate had a long big league career. I think he's a 6-7 year guy. But it was crazy because, you know, like, I've been reached out to by USA, Team USA, Paul Seiler, you know, reached out to me. And he's like, hey, you know, and kind of let's backtrack just a second. So I was in the year before, I was in Asheville, North Carolina, pitching in the Ivy League. And I was doing a chart, you know, starting pitchers do a chart in between. And there's an older gentleman that's sitting in the front row right in front of me. And I notice him, but I just can't, you know, it's not coming to me who he is. And I'm looking, and I'm like, and I was always like a baseball historian, and like now the kids nowadays that are playing, like, they don't really know like who came before them kind of thing oftentimes. It's not a matter of like they don't respect it or, you know, anything like that. It's just they just aren't aware, you know, like at the same level. But and then I figured out it was Davey Johnson.
Oh.
So I'm talking to Davey Johnson, doing my chart, doing my thing, and he and I are talking, and we're hitting it off, and he's like, man, you're having a monster year, and he's telling me all these things, and he's like, well, maybe you get to pitch for me someday. So then I get called the next year by Paul Seiler with Team USA, you know, and I'm like, holy crap, you know, and he's like, well, you know, we're looking at doing the Futures game differently this year. It's not just prospects. We're looking for the best players that will fit to go to the Beijing Olympics. And so then at that point, he said, well, we got a great manager who's been around a long time. And he's like, well, it's Davey Johnson. And I said, wow, you know, incredible. I'm like, I was just talking to this guy a year ago. And obviously, I made a good impression. So my name stuck with him. He followed me. And I truly believe to this day that it wasn't really Paul Seiler that had his eye on me so much. It was Davey Johnson.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And in all, you know, everything you did in baseball, where does the Futures game in Team USA kind of rank?
It was really up there. Ultimately, I didn't get to, you know, like, participate in the Olympics, you know, like I would have wanted to. But, I mean, I'll never forget being able to go in the original Yankee Stadium and just, like I couldn't feel anything warming up. Like, when I got the call, they're like, well, actually, what's really interesting is I thought the Futures game was going to get taken away from me because I had spent time on the disabled list earlier that year in San Antonio, like, right before, leading up to the Futures game date. I get hit by a line drive in my land leg foot, and I broke three toes, you know, like, so I thought that I was going to get taken away from me. They were going to have to sub me out, and then finally I was able to make it back. I was a pretty quick healer and made it back, and the Futures game was my first time on a live mound since breaking three toes, you know, like, and they put me at the very back end of the game because they were like, listen, this guy's a starter, you know, like, we need to get in multiple innings, and then literally, you know, he had told me, hey, I'm going to put you back there, and if we're in a close tie game situation, you could potentially go two or three innings here because we don't have any other pitching. And I'm like, perfect. You're going to run me out there two, three innings. Everybody else gets one. I'm like, heck yeah, that's money in the bank, you know. But I remember coming into that game. We ultimately lost, but we were down that inning. You know, I'm in there in the ninth inning, and I'm warming up Monument Park, and I'm just like trying to like focus and get in the game and lock in, but I'm also reflecting like, I'm from Limestone College, and I'm standing in the most hallowed ground of baseball immortality, trying to get ready for a game that I'm pitching against the best prospects in all of baseball, and like 95% of these guys are big leaguers, you know, at some point. And I'm just like, came to that realization, like, man, this is, I'm close, you know, I'm close. And I mean, I took dirt home, I took my, I mean, I've got so many interesting, like, keepsakes and stuff like that, and I still look at that picture on my phone sometimes. I took with my college roommate. He came up, and we've got a picture with me on the field in my USA jersey, and you can see all the lattice work, the white fencing on the original Yankee Stadium in the back. Every time I see it, I'm like extremely moved by that. I mean, it was super humbling.
Did you get to hang around? Because that's the Josh Hamilton Home Run Derby All-Star Game.
It is. So they had a pretty chalk schedule for us, actually. And I mean, it was pretty overwhelming, because I mean, not only like did I have my representation at the time in town, you know, friends, family. So I'm like trying to allot my time, get my schedule done with what they laid out, but then obviously have some fun too. Like, and it wasn't my first time in New York. You know, I had a longtime girlfriend that lived in Long Island for the longest time. So I've been to the city before. I originally thought the Mets were going to draft me first and foremost out of college. They seemed the most interested, and I really had heard from the Giants a couple times, but you know, it ended up going to San Fran. And so I had been with the city, or been in the city, and was familiar with it. But at the same time, I mean, they gave us a pretty stacked schedule. I mean, I didn't have a ton of time, but yeah, I did. I was able to see that. That was really cool. I was a little hungover, I'm not going to lie, because we had a Maxim party that night, and there were girls everywhere. And I mean, it was, yeah. It was a bit of a blur, but the next day obviously shook some of that off.
I mean, you don't often get an off day in the minor leagues, so no, that's really what you had. Even if you had been in, you know, in some random Cal League town, you got to take advantage of the off day.
Well, that's the thing too, is like, I mean, it reminded me like earlier, in it, so like I pretty much did it like, so the Cal League, I made the Cal League All-Star team, and I went from California to Myrtle Beach. They had it in Myrtle Beach, and I'm like, great, I'm going to have, you know, 200 people there, they're all from my hometown, 3-hour drive to Myrtle Beach, you know, like, I did that in the Futures game, like, within 2 weeks, like, that's a freaking haul, like, you don't realize, like, going from California to the East Coast, and then back in 2.5 days, 3 days, like, it's not fun, but again, you know, it's just part of the territory.
With that, I always like asking, you do the Futures game, you also do the Fall League that year, when it's all, you know, Fall League is obviously for top prospects. Futures game is, you know, top of the top. When you're surrounded by all these guys, best of the best, were there guys for you that you watched that like stood out? Like this guy's different.
That's a really long list. That would be a heck of a long podcast. I mean, there were so many. I mean, like, obviously, like, Pablo Sandoval was one that was just unbelievable. Emmanuel Burris was in my draft class, and obviously Tim Lincecum was in my draft class. I'll never forget, the first time Tim Lincecum walked in after we had signed him, after their negotiations and everything, walked in the clubhouse. And our, backup catcher then, I won't say his name, I don't want to embarrass him, but he was like our third string catcher, kind of like a, not like a taxi squad player, but, he knew he was going to be like a third, he was a D2 guy too. And Lincecum walks in and drops his bag off, and, this catcher says, walks up to him and has no idea who he is, and he's a very homely looking guy, at least early, kind of before he got a little bit more cleaned up and whatnot. And hands him his cleats. The catcher hands Tim Lincecum his cleats, and he's like, "Hey, man, I need you to shine these up for me and get them back for me before game time." So Tim takes them, and Tim's like, "Okay," walks him outside and just chucks them. And then the guy's completely oblivious that that's your $5 million 10th pick overall future Cy Young winner, Tim Lincecum. And I'll never forget his first outing. It strikes up the side on 9 pitches, and they're all 96 miles an hour or harder, and they're all straight fastballs, and I mean, he's blowing out, he said Tyler Colvin was in one of those, was in that inning. I mean, first inning, I'm looking over, and I'm like, we don't have a freaking chance. I got no shot in it. This is what you're up against. And then, obviously, Pablo was incredible because Pablo was my catcher in 2008. A lot of people don't realize that. He wasn't a third baseman. He was a freaking catcher, and he was a dang good catcher. But then, they moved him out of there because they had drafted a guy named Buster Posey,
Turned out okay.
Turned out all right. And like I said, those guys, you run into those guys, you know it instantly. Buster walks in 2008, you know it instantly, and those guys are just on another level of not only talent, but maturity. I mean, Buster walks in and I know Jeremy here at the bar, he did test too. Him and Buster are still very close. And he's a guy that walks in and he's been in the room for 2 years already. That's just the kind of presence and maturity that he had. I mean, he was only 21 or whatever when we picked him up and signed him. But he acted like he was 41, just the way he was and his demeanor and everything. And it's special. I mean, that's the best word for it. They're special.
You get to, you finish up pretty much not a miracle season, but an incredible year. When you get to AAA, the numbers just aren't the same between your years in AAA with the Giants. You then get traded for Jose Guillen, arm strength legend. What for you made the difference in AAA? And I think now with 10 years of retrospection, are there what were adjustments that you maybe needed to make that didn't get made, or with baseball, a lot of it, we were texting about this last week, a lot of it is timing, a lot of it is luck.
So for me, my first year in AAA, I went from high A to AAA. Didn't do any time in AA on my way up. I eventually circled back to AA with the Nationals organization later on. That was actually my first time in AA. But so my first half, I was 10-1 with a 3. And made the All-Star team, all that. There was a lot of chatter around me when I was going to make my debut, all the blogospheres and, everything else that was running rampant then, and other people, kind of like Jeremy, were like, man, this is one of the best guys we had in camp, and now he's killing it, what is going on here? So at that point, at that halfway point, I don't want to say I started getting a little bitter, but I was kind of what else do I have to do? And at that point, ABT started coming into my head, and I kind of have that now, not only with work, but I'm a big bow hunter and I love archery, and I'm always tinkering, so at that point I'm I've got to do something different. There's a reason why I'm being kept out. I'm 10-1 in AAA, made the All-Star team. At that point, I'd made an All-Star team everywhere I'd ever been, always put up numbers. I've got to start tinkering and doing something different because clearly I don't have it. And I'll never forget it. I came back from made my first start after the All-Star break, and our pitching coordinator was in town, and he's like, listen, we're going to teach you a slider. You need a slider, you don't have a slider, you have a fastball, changeup, curveball, and then obviously your sinker. And I had just thrown 117 pitches, 2 days before. So, like, he comes in and he's teaching me all these slider grips, and he's like, we're just going to go out and pin and rip sliders. And I'm like, I'm hanging 117 pitches, and I'm out there ripping sliders, and, like, my season after that point, I don't know if it had to do with, like, arm fatigue or what, but I might have thrown 100 sliders. I don't know. And, like, it was... And I mean, he's yelling at me. He's an old school guy. Like, you know, when are you going to understand? Like, this is the reason why you're not in the big leagues right now on AT&T and helping us out. You know, like, you need another breaking ball. You know, like, and it just didn't come naturally to me. It really didn't.
Had there been any talk beforehand? Because you've been a three-pitch guy for 2 or 3 years. There been any talk beforehand of, hey, you need to add another breaker?
No. And I could sense his frustration because, like, you know, at the same time, it's like, he always wanted the best for me. We always had some really hard conversations, you know, but at that time it was like, man, was that the best time? Because I didn't have the best start against Memphis that night, but like, we're in the bullpen and it's hot and I'm throwing 100, dude, 100 sliders of every divot. Like, start out some at 45 feet, went to 55 feet, went to 65 feet, you know, just to try and throw stuff against the wall and try and figure it out. And it just... It was really rough. And then after that point, like, they were like, okay, we want you to implement it 55% of the time in your next games. And then so, like, and that's the tale of the two halves and the tale of the two numbers that, like, I look back on and I'm like, I'm never going to get that back. Because the minor league is all about development. But for me, it was like, if I put up numbers long enough, my approach was nobody can deny me forever. Because, I mean, at that point, I think it was like 55 and 15 in my career or something like that. You know, with like a 3-2, something like that. I mean, like, more than enough. But from that point on, I was being somebody that I wasn't. I never was that guy. Like, I never was a slider guy. I mean, like, I had never thrown a slider in my previous 24 years on Earth. And then they wanted me to do this and throw it 55% of the time. So I was doing things that weren't necessarily my strengths just to figure something out so I could, you know, kind of springboard myself in there the following year. Or hopefully in September, you know, is what I was really aiming for. But I think my second half number, I was like 1-6 down the stretch. Like with like a 7.5. Like completely uncharacteristic. And then slider was part of my repertoire after that going forward. And then the next year it was just, man, like, I had an unbelievable spring training. I think I gave up one earned run. I was making starts for Jonathan Sanchez. He was in the World Baseball Classic. And I think I threw 22 innings and gave up one run. And, I mean, I had a phenomenal spring. Best ever. And I was a couple innings short of, like, actually breaking a Cactus League record. I found out later about that. But, and I was starting the entire time. And everybody thought I was going to make the team that year. And I was like, man, I'm going to make the team. And got all the way to the Bay Bridge series, and Barry Zito was starting one night, and I was not supposed to start. I mean, I'm in the dang dugout, and I've got flats on and a jacket, and it's like, I had a jersey on, but I had a jacket and my shoes, and literally Boach looks down at me, and he's like, Posadas, go warm up. And I'm like, I've never come out of the bullpen. The only time I ever came out of the bullpen was during All-Star games, you know? And I got cut right after the game. I gave up, I think, 2 runs, and that was, like, literally my first earned runs of the entire spring. You know, it was in Pac Bell Park at the time. I think it was Pac Bell, yeah. And right after Barry Zito in a long relief outing, never had done long relief in spring training or anything like that, and I was on a bus to AAA right after. So I literally had guys coming up to me like Jeremy saying, you're making the team, dude, you're still here. There's nobody else left to cut. You know, like, you're here.
It's funny. One of our mutual friends, Sam Wolf, kind of same thing. He made, when he was with the Rangers, pitched in the big league game that is right before the season starts. The Rangers did it here at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. They did the kind of an exhibition series and then, you know, cut the next day back to AAA. And like Sam, neither of you eventually made that elusive debut. Obviously not to spoil the rest of the show, but like when you look back on that, how much would one start, one inning, would it actually change how you view your career?
Yes and no. And you know, everybody wants that like I guess, coronation of, you know, all the hard work, dedication, everything like that. But the way I look at it, and still to this day, and my wife has a little bit, like, tough time with it, 'cause she wasn't around, like, really, like, during the good days. So it was kind of like towards the end, this frustration of converting to a knuckleball, me being mad, pissed off all the time, like, why am I doing, like, because it's extremely humbling, you know, like, and it's such a fickle pitch, and it's just such a fickle demeanor that goes along with it. But, like, so for me, I did way more than I was supposed to ever do. And, like, I literally look at it from that perspective, like, I was never supposed to get drafted. I was never supposed to freaking win a minor league signing. I was never supposed to do any of that because it was a 17th round, roll of dice, small D2 kid that could pitch a little. So, like, that's how still to this day, like, a lot of guys, it would eat him alive, but it doesn't eat me alive because I'm like, I had a pretty damn good run. I played a long time, made some money, you know, didn't make any in the big leagues, but I made some money elsewhere, and I met a lot of really cool people, and I'm still involved in the game in some capacity. It's pretty dang cool.
That would be a great quote to wrap the show on, but you did try to throw a knuckleball, and I just you're you know, you've gone through a couple organizations, you're kind of on last gasp with the Rangers, and they come to you and say, hey, R.A. Dickey's having some success, why don't you have that same success?
Well, that's probably my biggest regret in all my baseball career, because for the first time, you know, I was a minor league free agent, and I followed the money, and was it necessarily the best thing for me to do? No. If I had to do it all over again, I would have signed back with the Washington Nationals. I had a great year with them. They love me. My manager, Matt Lee Crow, was a Carolina guy at the time. Like,
another Twins legend. Let the record show.
Twins legend, yeah. And like, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't have taken, you know, double the money to go to Texas. But again, you know, on a personal level, I met my wife in Texas playing for the Texas Rangers. So that part worked out. But as far as my playing career goes, like, I would have never, like, done that. And they literally signed me to an extension in the middle of my first year for the following year if I would convert to a knuckleball. And, like, literally, I was screwing around with it in spring training. Our pitching coordinator, pitching rover guy, was like, dang, thing's pretty good. I mean, and they did a lot for me as far as resources, you know, put me in touch with RA. I had several conversations with RA, and I trained here in Houston in the off season. They flew me out to Houston to work with another knuckleballer, and Steve Sparks, who's an announcer for the Astros. And I worked with Steve, and it's like, I was doing it my way. Like, I kind of done everything in my career up to that point, doing it my way. It was unconventional, you know, like, I was a little bit of crossbody, you know, when I threw it, but the pitch was the best that it ever was. And then I tried being more like Steve Sparks and throwing it the way Steve Sparks would throw it, you know, like getting all this counsel, started changing my delivery and everything like that. And then it's like the pitch regressed. It got worse instead of like me being me and just doing what comes natural when it was really good. And that's why I say it's such a fickle pitch. And then the fickle demeanor that goes along with it, because you're always like, I always had a huge, like, set of, like, just bravado about me, where it's like, I'll throw you 88 down the middle, like, whatever happens, happens kind of thing. So, like, I was perfect for the knuckleball because my arm stroke was really consistent. And I had enough courage and enough guile and enough balls to throw a pitch up there at 70 miles an hour and, like, not be afraid it's going to come back at me at 107. You know, like, I just had that about me. I didn't care. I'm like playing with house money still kind of thing.
Is the knuckleball like a golf swing where it's got to be dialed for you to flush it? Like everything has to go right? Because if it doesn't dance, it's meat.
So, yes. And it's kind of like the same phenomenon you get with like, or the same, what's the word I'm looking for here? Like same stimulation you get when you hit a golf ball. Like when you pure a golf shot, you don't feel anything. It's the same way with a knuckleball. When you throw a knuckleball and, like, it just clicks, it comes off perfect, like, I mean, dude, I was doing all sorts of, like, quirky stuff. Like, I was going to get my nails done on road trips. Like, it was really humiliating at times.
It's a lifestyle.
It's a lifestyle, 100%. And but literally, like, when it clicks and you get a perfect release and everything works, it's just, like, you don't feel anything. It's like a pure golf shot. You're like, man, like, you don't feel feel anything. You don't feel the ball hit the face of the club. You don't feel anything. It's just like when you barrel a home run, you know, like, and I almost had one of those in the minor leagues. I'm still upset I didn't. I hit the top of the wall in AAA. But anyways, you don't feel anything. You get the contact, and it's just like, oh, what happened? And then the knuckleball was just like that. And pitching conventionally, I never got that, like, never once had that stimulation, never once. It was crazy. But with a knuckleball, it's just like all the world came into sync at this one perfect moment, and you throw it, and that thing butterflies, and then, like, you're like, oh, man, this is great, and then your catcher misses it by 3 feet, and runners advance 3 bases. So that was always the fun part of it. It's like, yeah, I can throw it. It's going to be nasty, but then the second part is he's not going to freaking catch it, and the batter sure as hell isn't going to hit it. So at that point, it's just like I'm waiting for the rebound to come back.
The knuckleball giveth and the knuckleball taketh away.
100%.
So you, after the knuckleball, you hang it up, you know, get into coaching, do a couple different things. When you look back now, if you could have given your 22-year-old self a pep talk right after signing before heading to the minor leagues, what would that pep talk look like?
Man, that's a great question. I think it would be, don't try and change who you are, man. Because like I said, I tried to do it and tried to kind of reinvent myself, you know, not only once with a slider, but twice later. It's just, yeah, I mean, that's literally what it would be. Because, and I think part of that, like I said, is like, even now, it's like I'm always tinkering around with something, trying to get an edge. And like, I kind of took on that persona instead of just really doing what I did best and stuck to my strength and kept putting up numbers. And somebody would eventually, you know, give me a shot, and if not, I could lay my head down and be all right, you know, because I was true to myself. I think that's the biggest thing. And, you know, it's one of those great parables, you know, call it, you know, from the Bible, you know thyself, you know, like it just, that's probably the biggest takeaway, you know, looking back. It's like, man, I tried to be two different people, you know, along the way, because people were dangling that carrot in front of me saying, if you do this, you'll pitch in the big leagues. You know, instead of me just keep my head down, keep doing what I was doing, and stay the course. So that's what I would do.
Quick rapid fire for you, and then I'll let you get out of here. Favorite minor league ballpark?
Ooh. That's a really good one. I would have to say, and this ballpark isn't around anymore, the AAA ballpark in Portland.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's a first for that one. Least favorite minor league ballpark?
I can't think of the name of it, but it was in the Cal League, Bakersfield, by far, not even close.
Also not around. best hitter you ever faced?
Mookie Betts.
How'd that go?
I don't know, it was 18 for 23 over a 4-game set. I don't know. Off of me, but, like, I saw him on rehab.
Was that summer in the Carolina League?
Yeah, I mean, like, I literally they sent me down there because I was battling a couple things. They sent me down there. I didn't think I would end up staying down there. But and then I converted fully to the knuckleball after that. But, yeah, I saw him, and I was telling guys, I'm like, this guy's going to be – and nobody knew who Mookie Betts was at that time, but I'm like, that guy's going to be special.
I worked for Salem that summer, and
And I didn't even – and what was crazy is, like, I didn't even – like, I saw Trout early, and, like, I own Trout. Like, Trout really didn't become Trout, I feel like, until he got to the big leagues, which is crazy because usually you don't see guys take those steps, like – in the big leagues. Like, it's crazy. Like, he went from literally, like, oh, man, he's a phenomenal guy to, like, oh, my God, he's Mickey Mantle, mm-hmm. You know, like, within a year. And Mookie kind of did that, too. But, like, I saw Mookie, and I was like, man, this guy, he's a generational-type player. But, yeah, I mean, like, and probably my favorite player that I ever pitched against was King Griffey. Saw King Griffey at the end, struck King Griffey out, and then he hit a home run off me right after, second at-bat. I tried to do the same sequence to him, and he knew that and hit it. And Peoria, during spring training, hit it about 460 opposite field.
Man, I hope I would have ran out and gotten the ball.
Well, what was crazy is, like, and I'll keep it super brief, but I was out of the start or whatever, and I was icing up, and I was in the clubhouse, and there's adjoining clubhouses there in Peoria, and he walked through ours to get to theirs, and he looked at me and, you know, true junior fashion, had the freaking hat flip back. And obviously he was at the very end, you know, but still, he was my guy. You grew up in the 90s, he's your guy, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the Braves pitching staff, Glavine, or in Griffey.
Yeah.
And, you know, he looked at me and kind of winked. He was like, man, you had me that first time. He's like, that's good stuff. I got you.
Had me in the first half, not gonna lie.
I was like, holy crap. I'm like, I was just like completely overcome. I'm not an impressionable person, but like, I was just overcome. You know, I really was. So.
All right. This one's tough. Carolina barbecue, Texas barbecue.
Texas, not even close.
Oh, really? Wow. Not fighting for the home state.
Not even close.
Okay. Last one. Everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
No, but I do have one from the Dominican.
Oh, yeah, those are the best. Hit me with it.
Riding back from the Capitol, and yeah, I was super tired. I think my greenies were off, or my greenie coffee. I can't really probably say that on the air. My greenie coffee, I was always clean. My greenie coffee wore off, and, man, I just crashed. I'm super tired. I'm laying on the freaking floor, like often as, you know, principals, and then literally, like, I get bounced, like I hear this giant boom, right? And I get bounced like from the bottom. I'm not a small guy. At that point, I was like 235, you know, 6'4". And like, I get jumped off the bottom about like 4.5 feet. And I hit the luggage rack with my back. We had run over a cow.
Oh my God.
In the middle of one of these Dominican back road highways that are poorly lit, we had hit a cow and this thing had catapulted me to the top of the overhead bins on this freaking charter bus. And dude, I'll never forget it. Like, I thought that I wasn't going to be able to make my net. Like, it rocked me that hard. And like, literally, like, and it was crazy because every bus ride after that, I kind of realized like what it was. Cause you'd get these bumps and they'd be like, oh, what is that? And you talk to one of the Dominican players and they're like, perro. You know, it's like, we would hit dogs, we would hit cows, you know, like it just didn't matter. Like, in the Dominican, like, stop signs are not even, like, relevant. You just honk twice and cruise through. I actually took that skill here with me to Texas. so I actually really don't stop ever. So if you see me out there, I'm not stopping. But...
Oh, man. Kevin, that is all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom on the Farm.
Absolutely. Awesome. Awesome time. Thanks, Kyle.
And that's it for today's episode from Phenom of the Farm. Big thanks to Kevin Pesadas for stopping by, sharing his story, or actually, you know, for meeting me up in person and sharing his story. A lot of fun there. Again, big thanks to Free Run Brewing and former Giants left-hander Jeremy Affeld for letting us use their studio. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we will see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.